caused by the murder of Chancellor Dollfuss by the Nazis. It mattered not to the generals, who went eagerly to work to build up Hitler's army. It mattered not to the industrialists, who turned enthusiastically to the profitable business of rearmament. Conservatives of the old school, decent Germans like Baron von Neurath in the Foreign Office and Dr. Schacht in the Reichsbank, did not resign. No one resigned. In fact, Dr. Schacht took on the added duties of Minister of Economics on August 2nd, the day Hitler seized the powers of the expiring president. And the German people? On August 19th, some 95% of those who had registered went to the polls, and 90%, more than 38 million of them, voted approval of Hitler's usurpation of complete power. Only 4.25 million Germans had the courage or the desire to vote no. No wonder that Hitler was in a confident mood when the Nazi Party Congress assembled in Nuremberg on September 4th. I watched him on the morning of the next day stride like a conquering emperor down the center aisle of the great flag-bedecked Luitpold Hall, while the band blared forth the Badenweiler March, and 30,000 hands were raised in the Nazi salute. A few moments later, he sat proudly in the center of the vast stage, with folded arms and shining eyes, as Gauleiter Adolf Wagner of Bavaria read the Führer's proclamation. The German form of life is definitely determined for the next 1,000 years. The age of nerves of the 19th century has found its close with us. There will be no other revolution in Germany for the next 1,000 years. Being mortal, he would not live 1,000 years, but as long as he lived, he would rule this great people as the most powerful and ruthless autocrat they had ever had. The venerable Hindenburg was no longer there to dispute his authority. The army was in his hands, bound to obedience by an oath no German soldier would lightly break. Indeed, all Germany and all the Germans were in his blood-stained hands now that the last recalcitrants had been done away with or had disappeared for good. "It is wonderful," he exulted at Nuremberg to the foreign correspondents at the end of the exhausting week of parades, speeches, pagan pageantry, and the most frenzied adulation for a public figure this writer had ever seen. Adolf Hitler had come a long way from the gutters of Vienna. He was only 45, and this was just the beginning. Even one returning to Germany for the first time since the death of the Republic could see that, whatever his crimes against humanity, Hitler had unleashed a dynamic force of incalculable proportions, which had long been pent up in the German people. To what purpose, he had already made clear in the pages of Mein Kampf and in 100 speeches which had gone unnoticed or unheeded or been ridiculed by so many, by almost everyone, within and especially without the Third Reich. Chapter 8. Life in the Third Reich, 1933-1937. It was at this time, in the late summer of 1934, that I came to live and work in the Third Reich. There was much that impressed, puzzled, and troubled a foreign observer about the new Germany. The overwhelming majority of Germans did not seem to mind that their personal freedom had been taken away, that so much of their culture had been destroyed and replaced with a mindless barbarism, or that their life and work had become regimented to a degree never before experienced even by a people accustomed for generations to a great deal of regimentation. In the background, to be sure, there lurked the terror of the Gestapo and the fear of the concentration camp for those who got out of line, or who had been communists or socialists, or too liberal or too pacifist, or who were Jews. The blood purge of June 30, 1934 was a warning of how ruthless the new leaders could be. Yet the Nazi terror in the early years affected the lives of relatively few Germans, and a newly arrived observer was somewhat surprised to see that the people of this country did not seem to feel that they were being cowed and held down by an unscrupulous and brutal dictatorship. On the contrary, they supported it with genuine enthusiasm. Somehow it imbued them with a new hope and a new confidence and an astonishing faith in the future of their country. Hitler was liquidating the past with all its frustrations and disappointments. Step by step, and rapidly, as we shall see in detail later, he was freeing Germany from the shackles of Versailles, confounding the victorious Allies, and making Germany militarily strong again. This was what most Germans wanted, and they were willing to make the sacrifices which the leader demanded of them to get it: the loss of personal freedom, a Spartan diet, guns before butter, and hard work. By the autumn of 1936, the problem of unemployment had been largely licked. Almost everyone had a job again, and one heard workers who had been deprived of their trade union rights joking over their full dinner pails that at least under Hitler there was no more freedom to starve. From February 1933 to the spring of 1937, the number of registered unemployed fell from 6 million to less than 1 million. Gemeinnutz vor Eigennutz, the common interest before self, was a popular Nazi slogan in those days. And though many a party leader, Goering above all, was secretly enriching himself and the profits of business were mounting, there was no doubt that the masses were taken in by the new National Socialism, which ostensibly put the welfare of the community above one's personal gain. The racial laws which excluded the Jews from the German community seemed to a foreign observer to be a shocking throwback to primitive times. But since the Nazi racial theories exalted the Germans as the salt of the earth and the master race, they were far from being unpopular. A few Germans one met, former socialists or liberals or devout Christians from the old conservative classes, were disgusted or even revolted by the persecution of the Jews. But though they helped to alleviate hardship in a number of individual cases, they did nothing to help stem the tide. What could they do? They would often put the question to you, and it was not an easy one to answer. The Germans heard vaguely in their censored press and broadcasts of the revulsion abroad, but they noticed that it did not prevent foreigners from flocking to the Third Reich and seemingly enjoying its hospitality. For Nazi Germany, much more than Soviet Russia, was open for all the world to see. Also, in contrast to the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany permitted all but a few thousand of its citizens who were in the Black Book of the secret police to travel abroad, though this was severely curtailed by currency restrictions because of the country's lack of foreign exchange. However, the currency restrictions were no more stringent than those for British citizens after 1945. The point is that the Nazi rulers did not seem to be worried that the average German would be contaminated by anti-Nazism if he visited the democratic countries. The tourist business thrived and brought in vast sums of badly needed foreign currency. Apparently, the Nazi leaders had nothing to hide. A foreigner, no matter how anti-Nazi, could come to Germany and see and study what he liked, with the exception of the concentration camps and, as in all countries, the military installations. And many did. And many returned who, if they were not converted, were at least rendered tolerant of the New Germany, and believed that they had seen, as they said, positive achievements. Even a man as perspicacious as Lloyd George, who had led England to victory over Germany in 1918, and who in that year had campaigned with an election slogan of "Hang the Kaiser," could visit Hitler at Obersalzberg in 1936 and go away enchanted with the Führer and praise him publicly as a great man, who had the vision and the will to solve a modern nation's social problems. Above all, unemployment, a sore which still festered in England and in regard to which the great wartime liberal leader with his program "We Can Conquer Unemployment" had found so little interest at home. The Olympic Games held in Berlin in August 1936 afforded the Nazis a golden opportunity to impress the world with the achievements of the Third Reich, and they made the most of it. The signs "Juden unerwünscht," Jews not welcome, were quietly hauled down from the shops, hotels, beer gardens, and places of public entertainment. The persecution of the Jews and of the two Christian churches temporarily halted, and the country put on its best behavior. No previous games had seen such a spectacular organization or such a lavish display of entertainment. Goering, Ribbentrop, and Goebbels gave dazzling parties for the foreign visitors. The propaganda minister's Italian night on the Feueninsel near Wannsee gathered more than 1,000 guests at dinner in a scene that resembled the Arabian Nights. The visitors, especially those from England and America, were greatly impressed by what they saw. Apparently a happy, healthy, friendly people united under Hitler. A far different picture, they said, than they had got from reading the newspaper dispatches from Berlin. And yet, underneath the surface, hidden from the tourists during those splendid late summer Olympic days in Berlin, and indeed overlooked by most Germans, or accepted by them with a startling passivity, There seemed to be, to a foreigner at least, a degrading transformation of German life. There was nothing hidden, of course, about the laws which Hitler decreed against the Jews or about the government-sponsored persecution of these hapless people. The so-called Nuremberg Laws of September 15, 1935, deprived the Jews of German citizenship, confining them to the status of subjects. It also forbade marriage between Jews and Aryans, as well as extramarital relations between them, and it prohibited Jews from employing female Aryan servants under 35 years of age. In the next few years, some 13 decrees supplementing the Nuremberg Laws would outlaw the Jew completely. But already by the summer of 1936, when the Germany which was host to the Olympic Games was enchanting the visitors from the West, the Jews had been excluded either by law or by Nazi terror, the latter often preceded the former, from public and private employment to such an extent that at least one half of them were without means of livelihood. In the first year of the Third Reich, 1933, they had been excluded from public office, the civil service, journalism, radio, farming, teaching, the theater, the films. In 1934, they were kicked out of the stock exchanges, and though the ban on their practicing the professions of law and medicine or engaging in business did not come legally until 1938, they were in practice removed from these fields by the time the first four-year period of Nazi rule had come to an end. Moreover, they were denied not only most of the amenities of life, but often even the necessities. In many a town, the Jew found it difficult, if not impossible, to purchase food. Over the doors of the grocery and butcher shops, the bakeries and the dairies, were signs, "Jews not admitted." In many communities, Jews could not procure milk even for their young children. Pharmacies would not sell them drugs or medicine. Hotels would not give them a night's lodging. And always, wherever they went, were the taunting signs, "Jews strictly forbidden in this town," or "Jews enter this place at their own risk." At a sharp bend in the road near Ludwigshafen was a sign, "Drive carefully, sharp curve, Jews 75 miles an hour." The author was violently attacked in the German press and on the radio and threatened with expulsion for having written a dispatch saying that some of these anti-Semitic signs were being removed for the duration of the Olympic Games. Such was the plight of the Jews at about the time the Festival of the Olympics was held in Germany. It was but the beginning of a road that would soon lead to their extinction by massacre. The persecution of the Christian churches. The Nazi war on the Christian churches began more moderately. Though Hitler, nominally a Catholic, had inveighed against political Catholicism in Mein Kampf and attacked both of the Christian churches for their failure to recognize the racial problem, he had, as we have seen, warned in his book that a political party must never lose sight of the fact that in all previous historical experience, a purely political party has never succeeded in producing a religious reformation. Article 24 of the party program had demanded liberty for all religious denominations in the state so far as they are not a danger to the moral feelings of the German race. The party stands for positive Christianity. In his speech of March 23, 1933, to the Reichstag, when the legislative body of Germany abandoned its functions to the dictator, Hitler paid tribute to the Christian faith as essential elements for safeguarding the soul of the German people, promised to respect their rights, declared that his government's ambition is a peaceful accord between church and state, and added, with an eye to the votes of the Catholic Center Party, which he received, that we hope to improve our friendly relations with the Holy See. Scarcely 4 months later, on July 20th, the Nazi government concluded a concordat with the Vatican in which it guaranteed the freedom of the Catholic religion and the right of the church to regulate her own affairs. The agreement, signed on behalf of Germany by Papen and of the Holy See by the then-Papal Secretary of State, Monsignor Pacelli, later Pope Pius XII, was hardly put to paper before it was being broken by the Nazi government. But coming as it did at a moment when the first excesses of the new regime in Germany had provoked worldwide revulsion, the Concordat undoubtedly lent the Hitler government much badly needed prestige. In an allocution to the Sacred College on June 2, 1945, Pope Pius XII defended the Concordat which he had signed, but described National Socialism, as he later came to know it, as the arrogant apostasy from Jesus Christ, the denial of his doctrine and of his work of redemption, the cult of violence, the idolatry of race and blood, the overthrow of human liberty and dignity. On July 25th, 5 days after the ratification of the Concordat, the German government promulgated a sterilization law, which particularly offended the Catholic Church. 5 days later, the first steps were taken to dissolve the Catholic Youth League. During the next years, thousands of Catholic priests, nuns, and lay leaders were arrested, many of them on trumped-up charges of immorality or of smuggling foreign currency. Erich Klausner, leader of Catholic Action, was, as we have seen, murdered in the June 30, 1934 purge. Scores of Catholic publications were suppressed, and even the sanctity of the confessional was violated by Gestapo agents. By the spring of 1937, the Catholic hierarchy in Germany, which, like most of the Protestant clergy, had at first tried to cooperate with the new regime, was thoroughly disillusioned. On March 14, 1937, Pope Pius XI issued an encyclical, Mit brennender Sorge, with burning sorrow, charging the Nazi government with evasion and violation of the Concordat, and accusing it of sowing the tares of suspicion, discord, hatred, calumny, of secret and open fundamental hostility to Christ and his Church. On the horizon of Germany, the Pope saw the threatening storm clouds of destructive religious wars, which have no other aim than of extermination. The Reverend Martin Niemöller had personally welcomed the coming to power of the Nazis in 1933. In that year, his autobiography, From U-Boat to Pulpit, had been published. The story of how this submarine commander in the First World War had become a prominent Protestant pastor was singled out for special praise in the Nazi press and became a bestseller. To Pastor Niemöller, as to many a Protestant clergyman, the 14 years of the Republic had been, as he said, years of darkness. And at the close of his autobiography, he added a note of satisfaction that the Nazi revolution had finally triumphed, and that it had brought about the national revival for which he himself had fought so long, for a time in the Free Corps, from which so many Nazi leaders had come. He was soon to experience a terrible disillusionment. The Protestants in Germany, as in the United States, were a divided faith. Only a very few, some 150,000 out of 45 million of them, belonged to the various free churches, such as the Baptists and Methodists. The rest belonged to 28 Lutheran and Reformed churches, of which the largest was the Church of the Old Prussian Union, with 18 million members. With the rise of National Socialism, there came further divisions among the Protestants. The more fanatical Nazis among them organized in 1932 the German Christians' Faith Movement, of which the most vehement leader was a certain Ludwig Müller, army chaplain of the East Prussian military district, a devoted follower of Hitler who had first brought the Führer together with General von Blomberg when the latter commanded the district. The German Christians ardently supported the Nazi doctrines of race and the leadership principle, and wanted them applied to a Reich Church which would bring all Protestants into one all-embracing body. In 1933, the German Christians had some 3,000 out of a total of 17,000 pastors, though their lay followers probably represented a larger percentage of churchgoers. Opposed to the German Christians was another minority group which called itself the Confessional Church. It had about the same number of pastors and was eventually led by Niemöller. It opposed the Nazification of the Protestant churches, rejected the Nazi racial theories, and denounced the anti-Christian doctrines of Rosenberg and other Nazi leaders. In between lay the majority of Protestants, who seemed too timid to join either of the two warring groups, who sat on the fence and eventually, for the most part, landed in the arms of Hitler, accepting his authority to intervene in church affairs and obeying his commands without open protest. It is difficult to understand the behavior of most German Protestants in the first Nazi years unless one is aware of two things, their history and the influence of Martin Luther. To avoid any misunderstanding, it might be well to point out here that the author is a Protestant. The great founder of Protestantism was both a passionate anti-Semite and a ferocious believer in absolute obedience to political authority. He wanted Germany rid of the Jews, and when they were sent away, he advised that they be deprived of all their cash and jewels and silver and gold. and furthermore, that their synagogues or schools be set on fire, that their houses be broken up and destroyed, and they be put under a roof or stable, like the gypsies, in misery and captivity, as they incessantly lament and complain to God about us. Advice that was literally followed 4 centuries later by Hitler, Goering, and Himmler. In what was perhaps the only popular revolt in German history, the peasant uprising of 1525, Luther advised the princes to adopt the most ruthless measures against the mad dogs, as he called the desperate, downtrodden peasants. Here, as in his utterances about the Jews, Luther employed a coarseness and brutality of language unequaled in German history until the Nazi time. The influence of this towering figure extended down the generations in Germany, especially among the Protestants. Among other results was the ease with which German Protestantism became the instrument of royal and princely absolutism, from the 16th century until the kings and princes were overthrown in 1918. The hereditary monarchs and petty rulers became the supreme bishops of the Protestant Church in their lands. Thus in Prussia, the Hohenzollern king was the head of the church. In no country, with the exception of Tsarist Russia, did the clergy become by tradition so completely servile to the political authority of the state. Its members, with few exceptions, stood solidly behind the king, the Junkers, and the army, and during the 19th century they dutifully opposed the rising liberal and democratic movements. Even the Weimar Republic was anathema to most Protestant pastors, not only because it had deposed the kings and princes, but because it drew its main support from the Catholics and the socialists. During the Reichstag elections, one could not help but notice that the Protestant clergy, Niemüller was typical, quite openly supported the nationalist and even the Nazi enemies of the Republic. Like Niemüller, most of the pastors welcomed the advent of Adolf Hitler to the chancellorship in 1933. They were soon to become acquainted with the very strong-arm Nazi tactics which had swept Hitler to political power. In July 1933, representatives of the Protestant churches had written a constitution for a new Reich Church, and it was formally recognized by the Reichstag on July 14th. Immediately, there broke out a heated struggle over the election of the first Reich bishop. Hitler insisted that his friend, Chaplain Müller, whom he had appointed as advisor on Protestant church affairs, be given this highest office. The leaders of the Church Federation proposed an eminent divine, Pastor Friedrich von Bulderschwing. But they were naive. The Nazi government intervened, dissolved a number of provincial church organizations, suspended from office several leading dignitaries of the Protestant churches, loosed the SA and the Gestapo on recalcitrant clergymen, in fact, terrorized all who supported Bulderschwing. On the eve of the elections of delegates to the synod which would elect the Reich bishop, Hitler personally took to the radio to urge the election of German Christians, whose candidate Müller was. The intimidation was highly successful. Bulderschwing, in the meantime, had been forced to withdraw his candidacy, and the elections returned a majority of German Christians, who in September at the Synod in Wittenberg, where Luther had first defied Rome, elected Müller Reich Bishop. But the new head of the church, a heavy-handed man, was not able to establish a unified church or to completely Nazify the Protestant congregations. On November 13, 1933, the day after the German people had overwhelmingly backed Hitler in a national plebiscite, the German Christians staged a massive rally in the Sportpalast in Berlin. A Dr. Reinhard Krause, the Berlin district leader of the sect, proposed the abandonment of the Old Testament, with its tales of cattle merchants and pimps, and the revision of the New Testament with the teaching of Jesus corresponding entirely with the demands of National Socialism. Resolutions were drawn up demanding one people, one Reich, one faith, requiring all pastors to take an oath of allegiance to Hitler, and insisting that all churches institute the Aryan paragraph and exclude converted Jews. This was too much even for the timid Protestants who had declined to take any part in the church war, and Bishop Müller was forced to suspend Dr. Krause and disavow him. In reality, the struggle between the Nazi government and the churches was the age-old one of what to render unto Caesar and what to God. So far as the Protestants were concerned, Hitler was insistent that if the Nazi German Christians could not bring the evangelical churches into line under Reich Bishop Müller, then the government itself would have to take over the direction of the churches. He had always had a certain contempt for the Protestants, who, though a tiny minority in his native Catholic Austria, comprised 2/3 of the citizens of Germany. "You can do anything you want with them," he once confided to his aides. "They will submit. They are insignificant little people, submissive as dogs, and they sweat with embarrassment when you talk to them." He was well aware that the resistance to the Nazification of the Protestant churches came from a minority of pastors and an even smaller minority of worshippers. By the beginning of 1934, the disillusioned Pastor Niemüller had become the guiding spirit of the minority resistance in both the confessional church and the Pastors' Emergency League. At the General Synod in Barmen in May 1934, and at a special meeting in Niemüller's Church of Jesus Christ at Dahlem, a suburb of Berlin, in November, the confessional church declared itself to be the legitimate Protestant Church of Germany and set up a provisional church government. Thus, there were now two groups, Reich Bishop Müller's and Niemüller's, claiming to legally constitute the church. It was obvious that the former army chaplain, despite his closeness to Hitler, had failed to integrate the Protestant churches. And at the end of 1935, after the Gestapo had arrested 700 confessional church pastors, he resigned his office and faded out of the picture. Already in July 1935, Hitler had appointed a Nazi lawyer friend, Dr. Hans Kerl, to be minister for church affairs, with instructions to make a second attempt to coordinate the Protestants. One of the milder Nazis and a somewhat cautious man, Kerl at first had considerable success. He succeeded not only in winning over the conservative clergy, which constituted the majority, but in setting up a church committee headed by the venerable Dr. Zöllner, who was respected by all factions, to work out a general settlement. Though Niemüller's group cooperated with the committee, it still maintained that it was the only legitimate church. When, in May 1936, it addressed a courteous but firm memorandum to Hitler protesting against the anti-Christian tendencies of the regime, denouncing the government's anti-Semitism and demanding an end to state interference in the churches, Frick, the Nazi Minister of the Interior, responded with ruthless action. Hundreds of confessional church pastors were arrested. One of the signers of the memorandum, Dr. Weissler, was murdered in the Sachsenhausen concentration camp. The funds of the confessional church were confiscated, and it was forbidden to make collections. On February 12, 1937, Dr. Zöllner resigned from the church committee. He had been restrained by the Gestapo from visiting Lübeck, where 9 Protestant pastors had been arrested, complaining that his work had been sabotaged by the church minister. Dr. Kerl replied the next day in a speech to a group of submissive churchmen. He accused the venerable Zöllner of failing to appreciate the Nazi doctrine of race, blood, and soil, and clearly revealed the government's hostility to both Protestant and Catholic churches. "The party," Kerl said, "stands on the basis of positive Christianity, and positive Christianity is National Socialism. National Socialism is the doing of God's will. God's will reveals itself in German blood. Dr. Zöllner and Count Galen, the Catholic Bishop of Münster, have tried to make clear to me that Christianity consists in faith in Christ as the Son of God. That makes me laugh. No, Christianity is not dependent upon the Apostles' Creed. True Christianity is represented by the party, and the German people are now called by the party and especially by the Führer to a real Christianity. The Führer is the herald of a new revelation." On the 1st of July, 1937, Dr. Niemüller was arrested and confined to Moabit prison in Berlin. On June 27th, he had preached to the congregation, which always overflowed his church at Dahlem, what was to be his last sermon in the Third Reich. As if he had a foreboding of what was to come, he said, "We have no more thought of using our own powers to escape the arm of the authorities than had the apostles of old. No more are we ready to keep silent at man's behest when God commands us to speak. For it is and must remain the case that we must obey God rather than man." After 8 months in prison, he was tried on March 2, 1938, before a Sondergericht, one of the special courts set up by the Nazis to try offenders against the state. And though acquitted of the main charge of underhand attacks against the state, was fined 2,000 marks and sentenced to 7 months' imprisonment for abuse of the pulpit and holding collections in his church. Since he had served more than this time, the court ordered his release, but he was seized by the Gestapo as he was leaving the courtroom, placed in protective custody, and confined in concentration camps, first at Sachsenhausen and then at Dachau, where he remained for 7 years until liberated by Allied troops. Some 807 other pastors and leading laymen of the Confessional Church were arrested in 1937, and hundreds more in the next couple of years. If the resistance of the Niemöller wing of the church was not completely broken, it was certainly bent. As for the majority of Protestant pastors, they, like almost everyone else in Germany, submitted in the face of Nazi terror. By the end of 1937, the highly respected Bishop Mararens of Hanover was induced by Dr. Kerl to make a public declaration that must have seemed especially humiliating to tougher men of God such as Niemöller. The National Socialist conception of life is the national and political teaching which determines and characterizes German manhood. As such, it is obligatory upon German Christians also. In the spring of 1938, Bishop Mararens took the final step of ordering all pastors in his diocese to swear a personal oath of allegiance to the Führer. In a short time, the vast majority of Protestant clergymen took the oath, thus binding themselves legally and morally to obey the commands of the dictator. It would be misleading to give the impression that the persecution of Protestants and Catholics by the Nazi state tore the German people asunder, or even greatly aroused the vast majority of them. It did not. A people who had so lightly given up their political and cultural and economic freedoms were not, except for a relatively few, going to die or even risk imprisonment to preserve freedom of worship. What really aroused the Germans in the 30s were the glittering successes of Hitler in providing jobs, creating prosperity, restoring Germany's military might, and moving from one triumph to another in his foreign policy. Not many Germans lost much sleep over the arrests of a few thousand pastors and priests, or over the quarreling of the various Protestant sects. And even fewer paused to reflect that under the leadership of Rosenberg, Bormann, and Himmler, who were backed by Hitler, the Nazi regime intended eventually to destroy Christianity in Germany, if it could, and substitute the old paganism of the early tribal Germanic gods and the new paganism of the Nazi extremists. As Bormann, one of the men closest to Hitler, said publicly in 1941, "National Socialism and Christianity are irreconcilable." What the Hitler government envisioned for Germany was clearly set out in a 30-point program for the National Reich Church, drawn up during the war by Rosenberg, an outspoken pagan, who among his other offices held that of the Führer's delegate for the entire intellectual and philosophical education and instruction for the National Socialist Party. A few of its 30 articles convey the essentials. 1. The National Reich Church of Germany categorically claims the exclusive right and the exclusive power to control all churches within the borders of the Reich. It declares these to be national churches of the German Reich. 5. The National Church is determined to exterminate irrevocably the strange and foreign Christian faiths imported into Germany in the ill-omened year 800. 7. The National Church has no scribes, pastors, chaplains, or priests, but National Reich orators are to speak in them. 13. The National Church demands immediate cessation of the publishing and dissemination of the Bible in Germany. 14. The National Church declares that to it, and therefore to the German nation, it has been decided that the Führer's Mein Kampf is the greatest of all documents. It not only contains the greatest, but it embodies the purest and truest ethics for the present and future life of our nation. 18. The National Church will clear away from its altars all crucifixes, Bibles, and pictures of saints. 19. On the altars there must be nothing but Mein Kampf, to the German nation and therefore to God the most sacred book, and to the left of the altar a sword. 30. On the day of its foundation, the Christian cross must be removed from all churches, cathedrals, and chapels, and it must be superseded by the only unconquerable symbol, the swastika. The Nazification of Culture. On the evening of May 10, 1933, some 4.5 months after Hitler became Chancellor, there occurred in Berlin a scene which had not been witnessed in the Western world since the late Middle Ages. At about midnight, a torchlight parade of thousands of students ended at a square on Unter den Linden, opposite the University of Berlin. Torches were put to a huge pile of books that had been gathered there, and as the flames enveloped them, more books were thrown on the fire until some 20,000 had been consumed. Similar scenes took place in several other cities. The book burning had begun. Many of the books tossed into the flames in Berlin that night by the joyous students under the approving eye of Dr. Goebbels had been written by authors of world reputation. They included, among German writers, Thomas and Heinrich Mann, Leon Fuchtwanger, Jakob Wassermann, Arnold and Stefan Zweig, Erich Maria Remarque, Walter Rathenau, Albert Einstein, Alfred Kerr, and Hugo Preuss, the last named being the scholar who had drafted the Weimar Constitution. But not only the works of dozens of German writers were burned, a good many foreign authors were also included. Jack London, Upton Sinclair, Helen Keller, Margaret Sanger, H.G. Wells, Havelock Ellis, Arthur Schnitzler, Freud, Gide, Zola, Proust. In the words of a student proclamation, any book was condemned to the flames which acts subversively on our future or strikes at the root of German thought, the German home, and the driving forces of our people. Dr. Goebbels, the new propaganda minister, who from now on was to put German culture into a Nazi straitjacket, addressed the students as the burning books turned to ashes. The soul of the German people can again express itself. These flames not only illuminate the final end of an old era, they also light up the new. The new Nazi era of German culture was illuminated not only by the bonfires of books and the more effective, if less symbolic, measures of proscribing the sale or library circulation of hundreds of volumes and the publishing of many new ones, but by the regimentation of culture on a scale which no modern Western nation had ever experienced. As early as September 22, 1933, the Reich Chamber of Culture had been set up by law under the direction of Dr. Goebbels. Its purpose was defined, in the words of the law, as follows. In order to pursue a policy of German culture, it is necessary to gather together the creative artists in all spheres into a unified organization under the leadership of the Reich. The Reich must not only determine the lines of progress, mental and spiritual, but also lead and organize the professions. 7 sub-chambers were established to guide and control every sphere of cultural life. The Reich Chambers of Fine Arts, Music, the Theater, Literature, the Press, Radio, and the Films. All persons engaged in these fields were obligated to join their respective chambers, whose decisions and directives had the validity of law. Among other powers, the chambers could expel or refuse to accept members for political unreliability, which meant that those who were even lukewarm about National Socialism could be, and usually were, excluded from practicing their profession or art, and thus deprived of a livelihood. No one who lived in Germany in the 30s, and who cared about such matters, can ever forget the sickening decline of the cultural standards of a people who had had such high ones for so long a time. This was inevitable, of course, the moment the Nazi leaders decided that the arts, literature, the press, radio, and the films must serve exclusively the propaganda purposes of the new regime and its outlandish philosophy. Not a single living German writer of any importance, with the exception of Ernst Jünger and Ernst Wiechert in the early years, was published in Germany during the Nazi time. Almost all of them, led by Thomas Mann, emigrated. The few who remained were silent or were silenced. Every manuscript of a book or play had to be submitted to the propaganda ministry before it could be approved for publication or production. Music fared best, if only because it was the least political of the arts and because the Germans had such a rich store of it from Bach through Beethoven and Mozart to Brahms. But the playing of Mendelssohn was banned because he was a Jew. The works of all Jewish composers were verboten, as was the music of Germany's leading modern composer, Paul Hindemith. Jews were quickly weeded out of the great symphony orchestras and the opera. Unlike the writers, most of the great figures of the German music world chose to remain in Nazi Germany and indeed lent their names and their talent to the new order. Wilhelm Furtwängler, one of the finest conductors of the century, remained. He was out of favor for a year in 1934 because of his defense of Hindemith, but returned to activity for the remaining years of Hitler's rule. Richard Strauss, perhaps the world's leading living composer, remained and indeed for a time became president of the Reich Music Chamber, lending his great name to Goebbels's prostituting of culture. Walter Gieseking, the eminent pianist, spent much of his time making tours in foreign countries which were organized or approved by the propaganda minister to promote German culture abroad. But because the musicians did not emigrate and because of Germany's great treasure of classical music, one could hear during the days of the Third Reich symphony music and opera performed magnificently. In this, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and the Berlin State Opera were preeminent. The excellent music fair did much to make people forget the degradation of the other arts and of so much of life under the Nazis. The theater, it must be said, retained much of its excellence as long as it stuck to classical plays. Max Reinhardt, of course, was gone, along with all other Jewish producers, directors, and actors. The Nazi playwrights were so ludicrously bad that the public stayed away from their offerings, which invariably had short runs. The president of the Reich Theater Chamber was one Hans Joost, an unsuccessful playwright who once had publicly boasted that whenever someone mentioned the word culture to him, he wanted to reach for his revolver. But even Joost and Goebbels, who determined what was played on the stage and who played and directed it, were unable to prevent the German theater from giving commendable and often moving performances of Goethe, Schiller, and Shakespeare. Strangely enough, some of Shaw's plays were permitted to be performed in Nazi Germany, perhaps because he poked fun at Englishmen and lampooned democracy, and perhaps, too, because his wit and left-wing political views escaped the Nazi mind. Strangest of all was the case of Germany's great playwright, Gerhard Hauptmann. Because he had been an ardent socialist, his plays had been banned from the imperial theaters during Kaiser Wilhelm II's time. During the Republic, he had been the most popular playwright in Germany, and indeed he retained that position in the Third Reich. His plays continued to be produced. I shall never forget the scene at the close of the first night of his last play, The Daughter of the Cathedral, when Hauptmann, a venerable figure with his flowing white hair tumbling down over his black cape, strode out of the theater arm in arm with Dr. Goebbels and Joost. He, like so many other eminent Germans, had made his peace with Hitler, and Goebbels, a shrewd man, had made much effective propaganda out of it, tirelessly reminding the German people and the outside world that Germany's greatest living playwright, the former socialist and the champion of the common man, had not only remained in the Third Reich, but had continued to write and have his plays produced. How sincere or opportunistic or merely changeable this aging playwright was may be gathered from what happened after the war. The American authorities, believing that Hauptmann had served the Nazis too well, banned his plays from the theaters in their sector in West Berlin, whereupon the Russians invited him to Berlin, welcomed him as a hero, and staged a gala cycle of his plays in East Berlin. And on October 6, 1945, Hauptmann sent a message to the communist-dominated Kulturbund for the democratic revival of Germany, wishing it well and expressing the hope that it would succeed in bringing about a spiritual rebirth of the German people. The Germany which had given the world a Dürer and a Cranach had not been preeminent in the fine arts in modern times. Though German expressionism in painting and the Munich Bauhaus architecture were interesting and original movements, and German artists had participated in all the 20th century evolutions and eruptions represented by Impressionism, Cubism, and Dadaism. To Hitler, who considered himself a genuine artist despite his early failures as one in Vienna, all modern art was degenerate and senseless. In Mein Kampf, he had delivered a long tirade on the subject, and one of his first acts after coming to power was to cleanse Germany of its decadent art and to attempt to substitute a new Germanic art. Some 6,500 modern paintings, not only the works of Germans such as Kokoschka and Grosch, but those of Cézanne, Van Gogh, Gauguin, Matisse, Picasso, and many others, were removed from German museums. What was to replace them was shown in the summer of 1937, when Hitler formally opened the House of German Art in Munich, in a drab pseudo-classic building which he had helped design and which he described as unparalleled and inimitable in its architecture. In this first exhibition of Nazi art were crammed some 900 works, selected from 15,000 submitted, of the worst junk this writer has ever seen in any country. Hitler himself made the final selection, and, according to some of the party comrades who were with him at the time, had become so incensed at some of the paintings accepted by the Nazi jury presided over by Adolf Ziegler, a mediocre painter who was president of the Reich Chamber of Art, that he not only ordered them thrown out, but had kicked holes with his jackboot through several of them. Ziegler owed his position to the happy circumstance that he had painted the portrait of Gailey Raubal. "I was always determined," he said in a long speech inaugurating the exhibition, "if fate ever gave us power, not to discuss these matters of artistic judgment, but to make decisions." And he had made them. In his speech, it was delivered on July 18, 1937, he laid down the Nazi line for German art. "Works of art that cannot be understood but need a swollen set of instructions to prove their right to exist and find their way to neurotics who are receptive to such stupid or insolent nonsense will no longer openly reach the German nation. Let no one have illusions. National Socialism has set out to purge the German Reich and our people of all those influences threatening its existence and character. With the opening of this exhibition has come the end of artistic lunacy, and with it the artistic pollution of our people." And yet some Germans, at least, especially in the art center of Germany, which Munich was, preferred to be artistically polluted. In another part of the city, in a ramshackle gallery that had to be reached through a narrow stairway, was an exhibition of degenerate art which Dr. Goebbels had organized to show the people what Hitler was rescuing them from. It contained a splendid selection of modern paintings, Kokoschka, Chagall, and Expressionist and Impressionist works. The day I visited it, after panting through the sprawling house of German art, it was crammed, with a long line forming down the creaking stairs and out into the street. In fact, the crowds besieging it became so great that Dr. Goebbels, incensed and embarrassed, soon closed it. The control of press, radio, films. Every morning, the editors of the Berlin daily newspapers and the correspondents of those published elsewhere in the Reich gathered at the propaganda ministry to be told by Dr. Goebbels or by one of his aides what news to print and suppress, how to write the news and headline it, what campaigns to call off or institute, and what editorials were desired for the day. In case of any misunderstanding, a daily written directive was furnished along with the oral instructions. For the smaller out-of-town papers and the periodicals, the directives were dispatched by telegram or by mail. To be an editor in the Third Reich, one had to be, in the first place, politically and racially clean. The Reich Press Law of October 4, 1933, which made journalism a public vocation, regulated by law, stipulated that all editors must possess German citizenship, be of Aryan descent, and not married to a Jew. Section 14 of the press law ordered editors to keep out of the newspapers anything which in any manner is misleading to the public, mixes selfish aims with community aims, tends to weaken the strength of the German Reich, outwardly or inwardly, the common will of the German people, the defense of Germany, its culture and economy, or offends the honor and dignity of Germany. An edict which, if it had been in effect before 1933, would have led to the suppression of every Nazi editor and publication in the country. It now led to the ousting of those journals and journalists who were not Nazi or who declined it to become so. One of the first to be forced out of business was the Vossische Zeitung. Founded in 1704 and numbering among its contributors in the past such names as Frederick the Great, Lessing, and Rathenau, it had become the leading newspaper of Germany, comparable to the Times of London and the New York Times. But it was liberal, and it was owned by the House of Ullstein, a Jewish firm. It went out of business on April 1, 1934, after 230 years of continuous publication. The Berliner Tageblatt, another world-renowned liberal newspaper, lingered on a little longer until 1937, though its owner, Hans Lachmann Mosse, a Jew, was forced to surrender his interest in the newspaper in the spring of 1933. Germany's third great liberal newspaper, the Frankfurter Zeitung, also continued to publish after divesting itself of its Jewish proprietor and editors. Rudolf Kircher, its London correspondent, an Anglophile and a liberal, became the editor, and, like Karl Zielex, editor of the conservative Deutsche Allgemeine Zeitung of Berlin, who had also been a London correspondent, a Rhodes Scholar, a passionate admirer of the British and a liberal, served the Nazis well, often becoming, as Otto Dietrich, the Reich press chief, once said of the former opposition papers, more papal than the Pope. That the last three newspapers survived was due partly to the influence of the German Foreign Office, which wanted these internationally known journals as a kind of showpiece to impress the outside world. They gave a respectability to Nazi Germany and at the same time peddled its propaganda. With all newspapers in Germany being told what to publish and how to write the news and editorials, it was inevitable that a deadly conformity would come over the nation's press. Even a people so regimented and so given to accepting authority became bored by the daily newspapers. Circulation declined even for the leading Nazi daily newspapers, such as the morning Völkischer Beobachter and the evening Der Angriff. And the total circulation of all journals fell off steeply as one paper after another went under or was taken over by Nazi publishers. In the first 4 years of the Third Reich, the number of daily newspapers declined from 3,607 to 2,671. But the country's loss of a free and varied press was the party's gain, at least financially. Max Amann, Hitler's top sergeant during the First World War and head of the Eir Verlag, the party's publishing firm, became the financial dictator of the German press. As Reich leader for the press and president of the press chamber, he had the legal right to suppress any publication he pleased, and the consequent power to buy it up for a song. In a short time, the Eir Verlag became a gigantic publishing empire, probably the largest and most lucrative in the world. Amann's own income skyrocketed from 108,000 marks in 1934 to 3,800,000 marks in 1942. Letter to the author from Professor Oren J. Hale, who has made a study of the surviving records of the Nazi publishing firm. Despite the drop in sales of many Nazi publications, the daily newspapers owned or controlled by the party or individual Nazis had two-thirds of the total daily circulation of 25 million by the time of the outbreak of the Second War. In an affidavit made at Nuremberg, Amann described how he operated. After the party came to power in 1933, many of these concerns, such as the Ullstein House, which were owned or controlled by Jewish interests or by political or religious interests hostile to the Nazi party, found it expedient to sell their newspapers or assets to the Eir concern. There was no free market for the sale of such properties, and the Eir Verlag was generally the only bidder. In this matter, the Eir Verlag, together with publishing concerns owned or controlled by it, expanded into a monopoly of the newspaper publishing business in Germany. The party investment in these publishing enterprises became financially very successful. It is a true statement to say that the basic purpose of the Nazi press program was to eliminate all the press which was in opposition to the party. At one period in 1934, both Amann and Goebbels appealed to the obsequious editors to make their papers less monotonous. Amann said he deplored the present far-reaching uniformity of the press, which is not a product of government measures and does not conform to the will of the government. One rash editor, Aim Welke, of the weekly Grüne Post, made the mistake of taking Amann and Goebbels seriously. He chided the propaganda ministry for its red tape and for the heavy hand with which it held down the press and made it so dull. His publication was promptly suspended for 3 months, and he himself dismissed by Goebbels and carted off to a concentration camp. The radio and the motion pictures were also quickly harnessed to serve the propaganda of the Nazi state. Goebbels had always seen in radio, television had not yet come in, the chief instrument of propaganda in modern society, and through the radio department of his ministry and the Chamber of Radio, he gained complete control of broadcasting and shaped it to his own ends. His task was made easier because in Germany, as in the other countries of Europe, broadcasting was a monopoly owned and operated by the state. In 1933, the Nazi government automatically found itself in possession of the Reich Broadcasting Corporation. The films remained in the hands of private firms, but the propaganda ministry and the Chamber of Films controlled every aspect of the industry. Their task being, in the words of an official commentary, to lift the film industry out of the sphere of liberal economic thoughts and thus enable it to receive those tasks which it has to fulfill in the National Socialist State. The result in both cases was to afflict the German people with radio programs and motion pictures as inane and boring as were the contents of their daily newspapers and periodicals. Even a public which usually submitted without protest to being told what was good for it revolted. The customers stayed away in droves from the Nazi films and jammed the houses which showed the few foreign pictures, mostly B-grade Hollywood, which Goebbels permitted to be exhibited on German screens. At one period in the mid-30s, the hissing of German films became so common that Wilhelm Frick, the Minister of the Interior, issued a stern warning against treasonable behavior on the part of cinema audiences. Likewise, the radio programs were so roundly criticized that the president of the radio chamber, one Horst Dressler Andres, declared that such carping was an insult to German culture and would not be tolerated. In those days, in the 30s, a German listener could still turn his dial to a score of foreign radio stations without, as happened later when the war began, risking having his head chopped off. And perhaps quite a few did, though it was this observer's impression that as the years went by, Dr. Goebbels proved himself right, in that the radio became by far the regime's most effective means of propaganda, doing more than any other single instrument of communication to shape the German people to Hitler's ends. I myself was to experience how easily one is taken in by a lying and censored press and radio in a totalitarian state. Though unlike most Germans, I had daily access to foreign newspapers, especially those of London, Paris, and Zurich, which arrived the day after publication, and though I listened regularly to the BBC and other foreign broadcasts, my job necessitated the spending of many hours a day in combing the German press, checking the German radio, conferring with Nazi officials, and going to party meetings. It was surprising and sometimes consternating to find that notwithstanding the opportunities I had to learn the facts, and despite one's inherent distrust of what one learned from Nazi sources, a steady diet over the years of falsifications and distortions made a certain impression on one's mind and often misled it. No one who has not lived for years in a totalitarian land can possibly conceive how difficult it is to escape the dread consequences of a regime's calculated and incessant propaganda. Often in a German home or office, or sometimes in a casual conversation with a stranger in a restaurant, a beer hall, a cafe, I would meet with the most outlandish assertions from seemingly educated and intelligent persons. It was obvious that they were parroting some piece of nonsense they had heard on the radio or read in the newspapers. Sometimes one was tempted to say as much, but on such occasions one was met with such a stare of incredulity, such a shock of silence, as if one had blasphemed the Almighty, that one realized how useless it was even to try to make contact with a mind which had become warped, and for whom the facts of life had become what Hitler and Goebbels, with their cynical disregard for truth, said they were. Education in the Third Reich. On April 30, 1934, Bernhard Rust, an Obergruppenführer in the SA, one-time Gauleiter of Hanover, a Nazi party member and friend of Hitler since the early 20s, was named Reich Minister of Science, Education, and Popular Culture. In the bizarre, topsy-turvy world of National Socialism, Rust was eminently fitted for this task. Since 1930, he had been an unemployed provincial schoolmaster, having been dismissed in that year by the local Republican authorities at Hanover for certain manifestations of instability of mind, though his fanatical Nazism may have been partly responsible for his ouster. For Dr. Rust preached the Nazi gospel with the zeal of a Goebbels and the fuzziness of a Rosenberg. Named Prussian Minister of Science, Art, and Education in February 1933, he boasted that he had succeeded overnight in liquidating the school as an institution of intellectual acrobatics. To such a mindless man was now entrusted dictatorial control over German science, the public schools, the institutions.